This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Jenny Wren. I've been a festival booker for over 15 years, mom of two, four if you count the dogs. I've buried my sister and my parents, partied like it was 1999 for over 20 years, modelled for 5 minutes, worn far too many accessories and not enough self-care. I've had breast cancer and epiphanies. Safe to say, she's been around. You're listening to Hindsight Conversations, where my guests are invited to bring to the table what it is they want to discuss, feel ready to share from where they are in their lives. We meet it together with no agenda. No topic is off limits, from the frivolous to the profound, the gnarly to the joyful, painful to the practical. Red flag moments you can only see when looking back, but looking back to move forward. Join me weekly where we explore the 2020 vision of hindsight. Everyone has it. This week's guest is Tony Walsh, archivist, journalist, and activist. Tony has been at the forefront of LGBT civil rights on the island of Ireland since 1979. He cut his teeth as a journalist at Out magazine, Ireland's first commercial gay periodical, in 1988. He co-founded GCN magazine. In 1997, he recognised the archive holdings of the National LGBT Federation into what would later become known as the Irish Queer Archive. The collection was transferred to state ownership in 2008. He recently launched a campaign to build an Irish AIDS memorial. The campaign is currently at community consultation stage and has the support of local government and Leinster House. Tony recently moved to Turkey to further his research and writing projects. And this is where we meet, where Tony discusses some very personal stories.
Thinking about what hindsight means and how I could apply it to, how I apply it to one big instance that looms large in my recent history. So we're talking about 2005. Now, some of this is actually, when I think back to it, actually, I feel some of it is, it is a mad mix of chaos and fun and sadness and grief and anger. There's a whole panoply of emotion, human emotions is going on here. So about 2005, I was 45, and I had just finished a significant relationship, come out of a significant relationship. And I was a bit of a walking cliche, really, when I think back now. I'm not sure what my self-awareness was like at the time, because, you know, you're consumed with, you know, the flotsam and jetsam of a relationship breakup. But I do remember actually going out and doing, carousing a lot, doing a lot of boozing, doing a lot of drugs, and getting the ride left, right, and centre. And one night, one night I was going home from Pod's dance club. Now, there was actually, this is 2005, and there was still an issue with taxis, like my taxis in Dublin, because I remember thinking I couldn't get a taxi, and I was living in Parnell Street, great gap, and the Chinatown end. And I decided to leave my record box in Pars, which I have to take home. And I sauntered home. Now, I've been DJing the Chocolate Bar Friday night. And I'd say I was a little bit ripped, probably stoned. And there might have been some other consumables as well. Definitely stoned. I mean, I don't smoke anymore, but certainly then. And I walked home. And when I'm coming up to the Gresham Hotel, this is like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, I see this guy on the steps of the hotel having a cigarette. And he's giving me the eye. And I remember thinking, God, getting this sort of frisson of excitement came over me. I thought, I haven't been cruised in years, since my 20s or whatever, anyway, a long time. And as I was getting closer, so anyway, we make eye contact, and as I'm approaching the hotel, he steps off the front and saunters up O'Connor Street and turns around the corner onto Cahill Brewer Street. And very measured pace, and I follow him around. I mean, that's where I'm going home. And I turn around the corner, and then I see him ducking down into the lane behind Gresham Hotel.
Okay.
And by the time I get to the top of the lane, I'm looking down the gloom, and I see him skulking in a doorway that's either the back of the Gresham or it's the Savoy or somewhere like that. Anyway, I just sort of really, my curiosity's peaked. And I go down, and when I pull up to him, he's having a wank.
Lovely.
And he wants to have sex with me then and there, and I'm just not really keen, because it's like November, December. It was cold, it was uncomfortable. You know, I thought, oh, fuck this. So I invited him home, because I only just lived 100 meters.
Around the corner.
Yeah. So brought him home, and we had really good sex. It was fun. And then, and I'd say there was probably some more weed involved. And anyway, I at some point I knocked myself out. And when I woke up, I actually found that he was inside me, and he wasn't using a condom.
Oh, God. Okay.
Now, the reason I'm going into all of this detail is I think the detail is really important to sort of explain the range of emotions that sort of hit me later on, okay?
Yes.
I'm not trying to sort of like be salacious or anything else, but it's just important that sort of detail that we sort of have some understanding of like how things unfolded.
Yeah.
So what started off as consensual sex ended up becoming very problematic. And when I came through, I just realized something wasn't right. I mean, it was quite clear he wasn't using condom, and it was a very messy scene. And
was he aggressive? Do you mind me asking?
No, nothing like that at all. Nothing like that at all. It was just all so easy.
Okay.
But uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Uncomfortable physically, and also uncomfortable psycho-emotionally. And McLean set us up, and then he said was getting a flight back to this, an Irish guy was getting a flight back to the States the next day, so he said, and he had to go back to the hotel. So he left me. Now, this is, we'd been there an hour or two, I don't know, a couple of hours. It's getting bright, so it must have been a few hours. And he goes back to the hotel, and I sort of clean up the bedroom, make myself a cup of tea, have a little bit of a cry. And in that moment, I realized that he probably infected me.
Wow.
With either HIV or hepatitis. I sort of just this, I don't know what it was, but just this penetrating realization that something awful had happened.
That happened. Wow.
Really, really hit me. And if you ask me, well, was there something specific to suggest why that, that was the case? I can't answer that. I just knew something wasn't right. I went to bed. So long story short, a few weeks later, I don't know how long, I got really ill. And basically I was seroconverting. And I got really, really ill. I knew instantly that it was either hepatitis or HIV because their epidemiology is quite similar. Now, you have to also understand, Jane, that I've both looked after individuals who've were in the later throes of HIV or full-blown AIDS, and are very familiar, the lifetime of experience of the epidemiology of HIV and some of the opportunistic infections that went with it, because I lived through the AIDS pandemic. So with an awful sense of foreboding, I went up to, got an appointment, went up to the Guy Clinic in St. James's Hospital. We do the bloods, and then they called me back in those days. Now, this is only 2015, so what's that like?
Not that long ago, yeah.
It doesn't seem like that long ago. But I'm thinking back now, and there's a whole load of things that's just so wrong about all this story. They call me back, and they get, and confirm that I was HIV positive. And I remember having just a quiet internal breakdown and thinking, fuck, 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 fuck. This is a Friday, and they asked me to go and see a counselor, and I had to sit through this really charming woman who's asking me a whole lot of questions and being very attentive and enabling, and all I could keep thinking was, I want to get the fuck out of here and just go home. And both annoyed with myself and also resigned to the reality. Now, where the hindsight involved in all of this is, well, first of all, I've been told since that medics would never give you a HIV diagnosis last thing on a Friday afternoon.
A Friday, oh my God, yeah, I can't.
Because actually, it's just so deadening for some people that, in fact, would be a worry that somebody's left on their own. Mm-hmm. And in fact, normally, if they know that you're getting a diagnosis, a positive diagnosis, they recommend that somebody actually come with you and you talk to somebody about it, which tells you an awful lot about the culture of fear, shame, and stigma that still lingers around HIV diagnosis. Because, of course, you don't have that if you're, okay, getting a positive chlamydia diagnosis is an awful thing, especially if you're a woman and with the potential to be become infertile. But, you know, all the rest is a bunch of box standard STIs. It's like, yeah, okay, give me the pills and I'm sorted and whatever, yeah, you know, and then we can move on. But I remember going home and for weeks, actually, I could say for a long time, for almost a decade, certainly all the time that my mother was alive, because I was actually, a year or two later, I left Dublin and I moved back to Clonmel to look after my mother, be a full-time carer to my mother. And my mother was aware I was HIV positive, but I never told her how I became positive. Now, the thing is, like, it's irrelevant how you become infected, you know, it's extraordinarily invasive of anyone to sort of even ask the question, you know.
Of course.
Happening.
Yeah.
It's like asking the question, how did you become accidentally pregnant, you know. It's just like,
exactly.
It's just a no-no. But it's, you know, in my case, it was so messy and so compromised. And it induced a range of emotions that sort of waxed and waned over the years until I finally managed to sort of like deal with it. I suppose actually writing about it from my one-man show 2 years ago was really helped me sort of put some closure on it, or certainly make some sense of it. It took me a long time to shake off the feeling that, like, I should have known better.
Yeah, I hear a lot of self-blame.
I could have done something to avoid this. Now while I'm saying this to you, I'm tiptoeing around the incident in the full knowledge that, you know, blame seems to be an intrinsic part of. Blame seems to be an intrinsic part of rape narratives. Mm-hmm. And there was undoubtedly a lot of that going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember sort of saying to myself, the blame game is like multifaceted here. There was guilt at allowing myself to be put myself in that position in the first place, that I should have somehow foregone the ride at 5 o'clock in the morning and the instant gratification, you know. There was regret, remorse at being stoned, at negotiating intimacy and desire 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning when my sort of... all of my senses weren't fully sort of like functioning, and the choices I make were going to be a little bit sort of skewered, I suppose. Inevitably, you know, if it's like it's early in the morning, you're not thinking straight, and your senses are dulled by like having a couple more, too many blunts and whatever, some gin and tonics, whatever I was drinking at the time. So there was that. And then it was also a profound sense of guilt and anger at becoming HIV positive at the age of 45.
Okay.
I mean, there's a twisted irony to this as well, you know, just sort of introduce a note of levity. So the guilt and remorse at becoming positive at 45, at a time when I had come out of the AIDS pandemic and lost countless numbers of friends who never managed to get to the sort of the sweet spot that I found myself in post-1996 with the arrival of antiretroviral therapies. And so I became positive at the age of 45, and I'm lucky enough to be a recipient of so much phenomenal change in pharmaceutical technology. So I just take one pill a day and then I can survive, you know? So there was like, but I still like, I just look back on that and it just, to me, it's just, it's masked. The whole incident is masked by a big why.
Yeah.
How did I? How could I? Why did that happen? If Pep had been available, I could have just run straight up to the hospital within 72 hours.
Okay.
It's like, you know, and got the equivalent of the morning after pill for HIV. Mm-hmm. and dealt with it. But that wasn't the case. And I, you know, when I sort of recall that period, it's my recollection of the period is just tinged with so much remorse and regret. I should say, I don't spend my time sort of beating myself up around the head over it, you know, it's done.
Good. That's good. I hear a lot of self-blame for a situation that was not of your doing.
So, obviously, I don't blame myself for being raped. You know, that's somebody else that was responsible for that. But I do regret not having, being in more control. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying this from the point of view of somebody who is actually a considerable control freak. I like being in control, you know. It's when I did recreational drugs in the past, I never liked, always liked that sweet spot. It's like a little bit like drinking alcohol, which of course is another neurotoxin, but you know, you get to a sweet spot where everything's sort of woozy and you know, you're
floaty but manageable.
It's lovely but manageable, yeah. And you still have some measure of control. And I've always liked that. So yes, I've always sort of regretted not being fully in control. Mm-hmm. And there's a sort of double whammy at work here, because it's not just about having been raped. It's about, as I said, I think actually what looms larger in this equation, what looms larger is that sort of paradoxical survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
Becoming infected at 45, you know, and kicking myself that I could allow that to happen, especially in the context of somebody who's, I like to imagine that I've sort of been a lifetime advocate for safer sex. Then I actually end up becoming infected. You know, when we're talking about this, I'm aware that, you know, I'm aware of the need to sort of tiptoe around this, these topics, because they're so shrouded in cultural moralizing. There's so much moralizing around going out and having sex, especially when you're on when you're drinking.
And do you mean tiptoeing around it for yourself, or just for the general, you know, for general public?
Both. I mean, I think it can be so easily misunderstood. And yet, do you remember the Belfast rugby rape case?
Yes.
A few years ago?
Yeah.
I followed that avidly, and I have never cried so much as I did when that testimony unfolded from that young woman. Because, and I also cried over the fact that so many people chose to dismiss her testimony. Mm-hmm. And try to devoice her, because I just saw myself in that position.
Yeah,
it was so crystal clear to me. How something that starts off as being consensual and fun,
it was. Yeah.
I mean, I picked up this guy in bizarre circumstances on the street, decided I wanted the sex to become
nocturnal fun. Yeah.
It started off as a fun, consensual thing and then slid into something very different, you know. I think unless you've been in that situation or you know somebody who's been in that situation, I think it's difficult for a lot of people to imagine how quickly and easy it can happen.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I think a lot of people, more than they would perhaps like to admit, understand very clearly how that tiny moment that everything changes and become, you know, from consensual to not. Mm. And I on hearing what, you know, what I'm hearing is like, do you feel that you tiptoe around it for yourself, that you were raped? Is that hard to...
I can't do anything about that. I suppose I'm just live with a... There's a sort of legacy of... maybe anger is too strong the word, Jenny, but like annoyance. It's like a sort of... It's like an itch that I scratch from time to time. This annoyance that I allowed my judgment to become clouded. Mm-hmm. Clouded because I got the horn. Or clouded because I was blunted or whatever, you know. You could, mm-hmm. I mean, I could pinpoint a couple of things, you know. I mean, that's the great thing about bloody hindsight, you know. Don't smoke that extra joint. Don't have that tonic.
Yeah.
Don't go down that dark lane. What did your grandmother say about walking into the forest and not leaving the path? Not leaving the path in the middle of the night. Actually, while we're on that subject, I used to call. I still refer to that lane as Gotham Alley. It's a really seedy, sleazy lane that goes down, right down past the Gresham Hotel, the Savoy Cinema, and then the back of the Pro Cathedral.
Okay.
And it used to, so it runs parallel to O'Connell Street, mainly O'Connell Street Upper. And then it opens out into Parnell Street, almost near where Eamon Doyle, techno DJ and fabulous photographer, one of my neighbors, dear friend. And I always used to be fascinated by the goings on in that.
Okay.
I should have known better to even take one foot into that place. A den of iniquity.
Did you or have you sought therapy? Have you looked at how have you dealt with it? How have you
by writing about it and
okay.
developing a scene for my one-man show?
Yeah. Which I got to see.
I remember my consultant, Gloria Courtney, fabulous woman who's been involved at the forefront of sexual health in the Guy Clinic in St. James's Hospital of Dublin. She was the first person who suggested a few years ago, and she was one of the few people who knew about it, actually, because I told no one. I told no one bar my ex-lover and one or two close friends.
Where are you with it now? How are you feeling now?
Ready to make fun of it, I suppose.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, actually, talking with you has helped enormously.
Well, I'm glad of that. And hindsight, because it is this, you know, my idea with this podcast or with this concept is, you know, that sometimes we're told, oh, you're not supposed to look back, you're supposed to look forward. But for me, the past has clues and it has jigsaw pieces. And it, you know, I am always looking forward. I always want to go forward. I'm not somebody who dwells in the past, but that if we can pick up those jigsaw pieces or those clues and help us create a more formed puzzle to go forward. Looking back now, aside from the emotions that you've talked about, what are you sorry that you didn't give yourself at the time?
Sorry, I suppose more time to process it initially, but it was the combination of a HIV positive diagnosis. I actually poured all of my, that required all of my attention.
Yeah.
So yeah. In a way I just, and then not long after the HIV diagnosis, I just, my mother needed me. So actually in some ways, you know, I'm thinking out loud here now, Jenny, but it strikes me that it's sort of also this classic behavior of lots of people in carers, that we might have some enduring issues that we need to deal with ourselves, but when we find ourselves in a situation where somebody else is depending on us, and it can be a child, it can be an elderly disabled grandparent or whatever, a parent, or a lover, or husband, or wife, that in fact, a lot of the time, our own individual needs are sidelined because we just simply have to. And by the way, I'm not moralizing about this. I'm not putting value on it. I'm just stating a fact.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That we tend to then, and certainly in my case, this is what happened. I just simply parked my response to, my response less to my HIV diagnosis, because I was like, you know, once I started taking my meds, like, okay, whatever, you know, there's more important things in the world to worry about, like getting heart disease or whatever, liver failure, or, you know, lines on my forehead. But it was the, yes, I definitely parked the, I didn't process the rape. Mm-hmm. I didn't process this initially. I didn't process it for a long time. So yes, if I had to go back, that's what I would do, because it induced such a range of responses.
Yeah.
Anger. A lot of anger and remorse. Mm-hmm. Remorse at just simply, you know, as I said earlier on, allowing it to happen or whatever else, in inverted, I'm saying that in inverted commas. So, yeah, I think if I'd dealt with it earlier, I probably wouldn't, I think it would have been much healthier to deal with it earlier. I don't believe it's also a classic illustration of that instance, classic illustration of me not taking my own medicine. Because I know when I'm in conversation with other friends, I will always say, deal with it now, deal with it now. Don't let it fester, you know, because I'm always prone to saying that secrets, there's a difference between secrets and privacy, and secrets are not healthy.
Okay,
and secrets corrode one's mental health, one's sense of self. But in this situation, I just simply parked it for a while. So yes, if I had to go back, I would just simply ensure that is dealt with in a sort of speedily manner, and whatever that takes. You're talking more about to people seeking some professional help. I don't know what else I could have done, really, you know?
This is it. And, you know, the other side of it is when I look back at some of my processes or lack thereof, I've had to really try and, which is not easy for me, kind of pour some love onto it and go, maybe that was the process. Maybe the fact that you turned to look after your mother, and that while you were doing that, it was that it's so big that we're not, you know, that we were doing maybe the best for ourselves, and that in just pressing pause and minding your mom allowed it to distill through your system in the way that it needed to do, you know?
That's a really smart observation, because I actually think when I say I parted, that's probably a wrong descriptor, because of course, inevitably nothing just sort of sits there.
No.
You know, it is, you're absolutely right. Things are filtering slowly, they're percolating. And there's no doubt that I'm sure I use that time subliminally to sort of like, you know, try and sort of process and make some sense of it. I also would say too that I would be inclined, if I had to sort of go back again, I would be inclined to lay off the blunts. Or maybe not lay off the weed, but I have to say that, like, when I look back on my life, I'm 60 years of age now, and when I look back on my life at some of the more problematic moments in my life and incidents that have created harm either to myself or to other people, they've invariably alcohol
or weed.
Alcohol has invariably been at the root of those problematic moments. So yeah, I think I've definitely learned a lesson. I've never been a huge drinker. I always preferred recreational drugs like ecstasy and acid or whatever. I think with a bit more hindsight, I would have been a lot more measured. I'm saying that fully cognizant and appreciative of the fact that I didn't cause this problem. I didn't cause the problem.
Yeah.
I'm fully aware of that, and I understand it and I believe it. But at the same time, I have to take responsibility for my own behavior, having had one too many drinks, you know, whatever else that happens from that. You know, it's, you walk down the street after sculling half a bottle of vodka and then fall and crack your head. Well, who's responsible for that? The pavement, bottle of vodka, drinking the bottle of vodka.
Yeah, you know? But if somebody comes along and rapes you while you're, you know, oblivious, it is not your fault.
No. And by the way, I don't want you to go away from this conversation imagining that I believe that for 1 minute.
No, I know you don't. I'm only repeating it because I just want to, I still feel there's, I can almost sense there's still that like self just, oh, fuck, you know, within you. And I get it. I understand it. I like, you know, and it's going to take time of just reminding yourself, you know, like that really wasn't my fault. And sexual desire and all of those things that you've advocated for. I mean, that you were perfectly within your rights. And yet I can still hear that little like, oh, fuck it. You know, I know it. But it wasn't your fault. And you were processing for many years and just some stuff was too big. I believe.
Mm-hmm. Here, here.
You know, some stuff is too big. Do you feel now you would like to speak about it more for others, for younger men, for older men, for others who may need to also just speak out their stories?
Definitely. I think we're not having enough conversations around, as I said earlier on, about how we negotiate desire and intimacy. Or if we do, it's in the context, the conversations we have are limited to either birth control or limited to STI avoidance.
Yeah.
But I think inevitably, especially if there's anything that might cloud decision-making, mm-hmm. like somebody is under a huge amount of stress, or they've partaken too much of substance, recreational substances, recreational drugs, or alcohol, then yes, I think we need to have conversations about our duty of care, not only to ourselves, but to the other person that we're engaging with. Our duty of concern to people whose judgment is skewered in these circumstances. I do put a huge value on occasions and platforms like this, the one we're sharing right now. I mean, I think these platforms, exchanges of information can be, and, you know, conversations of exchange of just sharing one's lived experience has enormous value. It has enormous value. And I just think that's enough for the moment.
I agree, and I'm kind of relieved and glad to hear you say that, because I was like, oh God, if he's going to start telling me now he's launching a... it's like, no. I'm very glad to hear your beautiful man and your self-care, and that it is enough. And it not even enough, Tony, I would go as far as to say it's a lot, actually, to have this conversation and to vocalize this that has happened to you. It's far more than enough. It's actually a lot. And well done, and thank you. And I feel always, I'm a massive believer in the power of conversation and the power of honesty and vulnerability. So it is far more than, you've already done a lot right now. But I was, as I said, so glad to hear the words self-care and your beautiful man and he's taking care of you. And that that already sounds like healing, because to allow somebody in to do that, I think, is also beautiful, you know.
Did I also mention that it's spring and it's 26 degrees at the moment?
No, you might have noticed I didn't ask you what the weather was like over there. I don't want to know. What are you sorry you didn't give up earlier?
Oh, that's easy to answer. Cigarettes.
Cigarettes. Okay. What are you sorry you didn't start earlier?
Credit union savings.
This has been brought to you by the credit union. Tony is now.
I am a major flag waiver for the credit union.
And in hindsight, what are you most proud of to date?
That's probably easy to answer. Setting up GCN, which almost contributed to relationship I had at the time breaking up. And was very fraught. I was in my late 20s, but seeing what it's become, one of the oldest LGBT community publishing ventures in the world, a great success and a reservoir of enormous talent, voices, opinion, expertise. So yeah, probably GCN.
I would have to say bravo to that, absolutely. And what might be, and we may not have gotten there yet, but from day one to age 60, what was the happiest part of your life?
There's never one sort of moment where I can. Happiest day is right now, I suppose. Living.
Great. Yeah. Being alive.
Right now, being alive. I do actually, Jenny. I do have take moments. You know, I'm an atheist, but I have moments that I suppose are akin to praying or meditation, where I just sort of try to denoise myself a little bit and just acknowledge acknowledge the place I find myself in, mm-hmm. and also acknowledge my gratefulness for just being in the situations I'm in. And I think that's a sort of progressive, continuous process. You know, just being alive, being healthy, being surrounded by friends who love me, I just feel privileged to, I feel privileged to have grown up being loved. You know, it's really, I think it's the thing that I, this is the thing that that gives me a great sense of wonder and delight.
I can really resonate with that, and I actually really understand what you mean, and we forget that sometimes. Thank you so much. I think that was amazing, and I feel very, very privileged to have had this conversation with you, and that you chose to have this conversation with me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And come find me over in Hindsight Conversations on Twitter and Instagram.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.